Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley. This is the Red Box podcast featuring the best of my Times radio show, Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. An extraordinarily packed show today. We spoke to Mike Barton, former Chief Constable of Durham Police. He had some strong words to say about Dominic Cummings and his trip to Barnard Castle. We also found out about Kevin the anorexic snake. We spoke to Ben Fogle about the smell of the countryside. But two really standout things from the show today, which we're going to bring you on the podcast. Later, a live rocket launch taking the Perseverance rover to Mars. But first, we talked Clement Attlee, 75 years after he became Prime Minister. Now then, 75 years ago this week in 1945, Clement Attlee, leader of the Labour Party, became Prime Minister. He took control of a war-ravaged Britain, a crippled economy and an employment crisis as millions of soldiers sought to return to the workforce. Right now, the contrast in style was between the two leaders of Britain's major political parties, Clement Attlee and Winston Churchill, couldn't have been starker. But perhaps again like now, the country had also emerged from crisis in the mood for some quite radical change when it came to how society was shaped. So what we're going to talk about now is how Labour can learn from Clement Attlee's victory, and also what lessons the Conservative Party can perhaps learn about how you emerge from a crisis with the public still on side. I'm joined now by Nick Thomas Simmons, the Shadow Home Secretary, but actually also a biographer of Clement Attlee. Attlee, A Life in Politics was published in 2010. Morning, Nick. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Matt.
We'll have you on another time to talk about your day job as Shadow Home Secretary, but we're keen to talk about your political work and biographies that you wrote before. Also joined by Professor Stephen Fielding, historian and author of The Labour Party from Callaghan to Corbyn, which is out next year. Morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Let's start. I'll start with you first of all, Stephen, as you'll sort of put this into context. Just explain why Attlee is such a huge figure in Labour Party history.
Well, I mean, when experts are asked who was the greatest Prime Minister in post-war Britain or 20th century Britain, they either put Attlee first, often first, or he's definitely in the top three. So he is a significant figure in terms of British history, political history, and has what his government did, the one that was elected on a landslide in 1945, the first Labour government to enjoy a majority in the House of Commons, in the circumstances that you described of, you know, economic crisis, just emerging out of the war, all kinds of things were going on. Despite all of those troubles, his government changed the course of British history. It instituted a cradle-to-the-grave welfare state, at the heart of which was the National Health Service, which, of course, is still with us, and made a tremendous impact on ordinary people's lives by making them feel safe from the impact of illness, unemployment and poverty, and also changed the nature of our economy. And on that basis, by nationalising 20% of industry, and obviously that has now gone by the board, thanks to Margaret Thatcher, she reversed that. But she couldn't really reverse, despite you know, clearly wanting to. The central achievement, the remaining central achievement of the Attlee administration, which was the National Health Service. So everybody's lives today, and particularly during the COVID crisis, which is, you know, clearly still with us, is affected by the actions of the government that he led. And he led it, you know, in a very, well, Nick will know much more about how Attlee actually did things, but he led it in the circumstances where he was actually, you know, elected, the government was elected, and yet it was a very divided party. Herbert Morris and his deputy tried to get rid of him. But he managed to get through all of that and to create a very different Britain to the one that went into the Second World War. And that many people, like Churchill, said, we can't afford to do any of this. And yet we could, and we did.
So, Nick, let me bring you in there. I'm sure you can't imagine a situation where a Labour leader oversaw a divided party and some people wanted to get rid of the leader. That's beyond your beyond your comprehension. But just explain for people what sort of man Clement Attlee was like, because obviously, you know, every school child could tell you lots of things about Winston Churchill, but probably not a huge amount about Clement Attlee.
I think that's probably right. And Attlee's, if you like, burning in sense of injustice, his real sense of wanting to change things, came from his experience prior to World War One in the East End of London. He had a very comfortable upbringing. He was born in 1883 in Putney, very Anglican upbringing with prayers before breakfast. Father was the president of the Law Society. Ellen came from a family of doctors. Went to Haileybury in 1896, and that is significant because it was regarded as the school that provided the civil servants who went out to India, and of course he was the prime minister who gave independence to India. But it was in that period prior to World War One, Haileybury sponsored the Stepney Boys Club, which looked to tackle and to assist poorer children in the East End of London. Attlee became its manager, and he drew a conclusion which never left him, which was that he wasn't opposed to charity. He thought charity was a good thing, but thought that charity in and of its own couldn't eliminate poverty. You had to have a government that systemically did it. And that's the belief that stayed with him. And of course, he came to actually then implement so many policies that looked to do that systematically after 1945.
And on the question of what the Labour Party, 75 years on, can learn from Clement Attlee, what are the lessons, do you think, in 21st century Britain?
Well, first of all, there's a very obvious immediate parallel between, I think, 1945 and today, in that there's been a period of extraordinary collective sacrifice. Very, very different, of course. The Second World War is obviously very different to the coronavirus crisis. But nonetheless, there is that theme of collective sacrifice and a sense that things should be different afterwards. So there's that immediate parallel. But in addition to that, I think the real lesson of Attlee is about constructive achievement. Attlee was interested in doing things. And you look at that period, particularly the period from 1945 to 1948 that Stephen was referring to with, you know, the welfare state, the NHS, the economic changes, and also, you know, the foreign policy as well, with independence for India, NATO, of course. There was this tremendous period of achievement that actually changed people's lives. And I think that's the thing that I've always found such an inspiration about Attlee. He wasn't someone who was terribly bothered about appearances and other things. And, you know, it's remarkable, really, that he engaged so little with the media, given that he was the prime minister. But it was doing things he was interested in and getting things done. And I think that remains a big inspiration today.
And Stephen, in the past, the sort of the Attlee legacy was appropriated by some supporters of Jeremy Corbyn. Do you think that was a fair comparison when people tried to draw that parallel?
Well, I could see what they were doing. I could see what they were trying to do, because obviously the Attlee government is associated with a vast extension of government intervention, of putting the state before the market and things like that. And Jeremy Corbyn was associated with that kind of an approach. But also Attlee was led the government that helped form NATO. that was actually quite patriotic in many of its kind of ways of thinking about the place of Britain in the world. And while it kind of decolonized and, you know, India gained its independence, it also sent troops to Korea when it was threatened by the Chinese communists. So that was kind of a bit of a disingenuous kind of appropriation. But I admired them for it. I mean, Boris Johnson has tried to appropriate Churchill for himself, and that's an equally ridiculous attempt. But nonetheless, it seems to have stuck a bit more.
Nick, who is the real heir to Attlee? Is it Jeremy Corbyn or Keir Starmer?
Well, I think that Keir Starmer, and this is one of the reasons I backed him for leader, will belong in the tradition of Labour leaders who won general elections. I'm afraid that it's not a particularly long list. It's only Attlee, of course, in 1945, 1950, Wilson and Tony Blair who won elections for Labour in the last 70-odd years. But I also think, you know, and I work with Keir Starmer on a daily basis, he certainly has, you know, Attlee's forensic approach and attention to detail in meetings. I mean, Attlee, by the way, had this wonderful way with meetings. His leadership style was about ensuring that a decision was reached. And he was a stickler for the agenda and a stickler for people not wasting time. And he once said that democracy was about discussion, but it only worked if you could stop people talking.
And is that your experience of Keir Starmer in meetings? Is he also a stickler for the agenda?
He's highly efficient with meetings, absolutely, and so he should be as well. There are important issues we have to discuss, and I think he's got this incredibly strong sense of purpose, which is one of the many things that makes him so great to work for.
Stephen also mentioned the issue of patriotism, and obviously one of the big dividing lines between the sort of the Attlee-Corbyn comparison is that Attlee was seen much more as a patriot, and it was a big criticism of Jeremy Corbyn that he wasn't. Do you think that Keir Starmer is in the same mould as Attlee, as someone who is patriotic?
He is very strongly patriotic and very much in that tradition. I mean, Attlee obviously had this very particular view of the world that came from his background. And his service, Attlee's service in World War One, is also something I think people often underrate when they interpret his life, because he wasn't someone who was conscripted. He, of course, volunteered in 1914 prior to the introduction of conscription. Even he suffered from dysentery on the beaches of Gallipoli and was given the option of either going back home to England or going to Malta and coming back to the fray. And he actually chose to go to Malta, came back to Gallipoli, and ended up in a situation where he was one of the last on the beach. So Attlee had this tremendously deep patriotism and sense of service that I think remained a theme throughout his life.
Oh, it's really good to speak to Nick Thomas-Simmons there, Attlee biographer and Shadow Home Secretary, joining us on Times Radio. Nick's got to go, but Stephen, you can stay with us for a few more minutes, I think.
OK, yeah.
What do you sort of... I mean, is the comparison... that, and obviously, Nick's got to be nice to his boss and draw the comparisons. You know, as he was saying, the list of Labour leaders who've won elections doesn't even require a whole hand. Is it a fair comparison to be sort of putting Keir Starmer up on that level yet? Or is it sort of too early to tell?
Well, it's too early to tell, to be completely definitive. And I'm a historian, so I need about 50 years before I can come to a conclusion about anything, really. But there are certain kind of obvious similarities, surface similarities. I mean, Starmer is starting with a manifesto, the 2019 manifesto, that is probably even more radical than the one that was put to the country in 1945. And we've yet to see what he's going to do with that manifesto. You know, what is he going to take out? But even if he takes out a few things, it's still going to be a very, very radical kind of promoting of the state over the market kind of an approach. But he clearly is going to kind of wrap that up with a more patriotic, a more kind of conventional kind of an approach to society than Jeremy Corbyn was associated with. I mean, that's the great difference between Starmer and Attlee and Corbyn, that he'll be kind of conservative with a small c, not you know, traditional, maybe he's going too far in terms of cultural issues, but much more radical than Miliband would have been, than certainly Tony Blair would have been, in terms of economic issues. And that's the mix that Attlee had. He was very culturally conservative, didn't challenge the grammar schools, kept the private schools in place and the BBC and the monarchy and everything. But he was tremendously radical in what he did to the economy and society.
And to what extent do parties think about history? Because obviously, generally, quite what happens if parties, internally and political obsessives within political parties, they get a bit caught up in history. You know, the Conservative Party, tying itself in knots for years and years about, Margaret Thatcher. In both directions, the Labour Party has basically spent the last decade tying itself in knots about what New Labour did. So how, in a way that where voters want to know about the future, not, comparing yourself to people they've barely heard of. Is history important to a political party in that sense?
Well, history can be a help and a hindrance at the same time, like you were saying about the legacy of Margaret Thatcher. But when we celebrated VE Day a few months ago, we were getting Winston Churchill, Winston Churchill, Winston Churchill. And in some sense, that permeates through to thinking, well, Winston Churchill, he was a conservative. He was about, he was very patriotic. He's associated with the war. And yet we never hear about Attlee. Winston Churchill was voted the greatest Briton in 2002. And Clement Attlee, the man who supported Churchill in the decision not to give in to Germany in 1940, in fact, was a very important figure. Him and Bevin were very important figures in making sure that the government fought on. And he ran Britain during the war and then went on to form that government that we've talked about, created the NHS. Clement Attlee wasn't even in the top 100. I mean, David Beckham was, Bono was, but not Clement Attlee. So, in the sense that it'd be quite important for Labour to put Attlee back in some way. So to at least challenge the idea that only the Conservatives, are associated with these great national events. Only Churchill is the person that can sort of is the person that we should turn to, or somebody who wants to be like Churchill, like Boris Johnson. There's a reason why Boris Johnson has constantly, he wrote that book about Churchill because he wanted people to think of him as being like Churchill. And, it can help. It can help you. And so I think it's a useful exercise for Labour to try to promote Attlee a little bit more, because Attlee at least is kind of sympathetic to what Starmer's trying to do. As I say, you be culturally conservative, you're reassuring. Attlee wasn't one for the big rhetoric. He hardly said anything really in public. And yet, because it's the Theodore Roosevelt quote that comes to mind about talk quietly and carry a big stick. Starmer's very much like that. He's very reassuring. He sounds very sensible. He looks very sensible. Looks very calm. He's saying things that many people want to hear. But he's also, behind him, it is a very radical program that he is potentially has already signed up to. And in these times of crisis, I think that seems to be what a lot of people want. But he says it in a reassuring way. And Attlee would be a reassuring historical figure to say, well, we've been here before. We've done it before, and Attlee is kind of the exemplar of Labour's done it in the past, we can do it in the future.
Well, it's really good to speak to you. That's Stephen Fielding, the historian, talking us through the legacy of Clement Attlee, became Prime Minister 75 years ago this week. If you like what you're hearing, you can listen to the whole of my Times Radio show, either listen back on the Times Radio app, or you can listen live Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. We'll have more on the episode after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times. in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Question that David Bowie asked, was it 49 years ago, I think, and 41 years ago, I think my math is slightly out. David Bowie, is there life on Mars? Well, we're getting closer, possibly, to finding out. Very excitingly, there's a new mission leaving NASA in the next 5 or 10 minutes, which is going to send a rover called Perseverance to Mars to try and see if there was or is any life on Mars. So here to talk us through What is the UK's involvement in this launch and what we might end up finding out is Sue Horne, Head of Space Exploration at the UK Space Agency. Afternoon, Sue.
Good afternoon.
That's about the coolest job title we've had on Times Radio so far, Head of Space Exploration at the UK Space Agency. This is exciting stuff, isn't it?
Yes, because we've been wanting to do this mission for about 40 years and it's only just now that the technology's there to do it. It's a very complex mission. The Perseverance is the first step. What we want to do is go to Mars, collect some rocks, and bring them back to Earth. So Perseverance is all about identifying the best rocks to come back to Earth, using a drill to take cores of those rocks and sealing them in a tube to be brought back to Earth.
But crucially, not by Perseverance.
Not by Perseverance. You've got to split it into several missions. So the mission after Perseverance, which will be either 2026 or 2028, will take a Mars Ascent Vehicle, basically a rocket, to take the samples from the surface of Mars back into orbit, and that will have with it a sample fetch rover. So that will travel from the Ascent Vehicle, go to where Perseverance has left the rock samples, collect the samples, and take them back and load them into the Ascent Vehicle. Now, that sample fetch rover is going to be built in the UK at Airbus in Stevenage, and that's all thanks to government investment in November, our contribution to the European Space Agency.
So we're helping out with getting the rocks from Mars back to Earth.
Yes, our scientists have also been involved in working out what are the best instruments to have on board Perseverance. We have scientists on the Perseverance science team that will help to select the rocks to be brought back.
And the how do you decide what rocks to bring back? Because, and I say this as someone who's not a scientist, don't all rocks look the same?
No. There are different forms of rocks. So there's some rocks formed from magma or lava. There's then rocks that have been processed. So they've been worn away by the weather and redeposited. So lake sediments, river sediments. And those are the ones that you're interested in because on Earth, that's what you're looking for when you're looking for fossils. Now, 3.5-4 billion years ago on Mars, Mars was very similar to the Earth. So it had water, it had a thicker atmosphere, and that was the time on Earth when life started to emerge. And the question is, did life emerge on Mars? And if so, has it left microfossils, fossils of the microbes that form them? We can now identify those microbes in Earth rocks. So we have the technology to find these little microbes. So what you're looking for is sedimentary rocks, the ones that have been laid down by layers, ones that have been rocks that have been altered by water, and with a high organic matter, so ones that contain carbon.
I do remember from my sort of geography lesson, sedimentary rock, and that's what you see down at Lyme Regis, isn't it? Where you can see the lines in the cliff walls, and that's where you find the fossils and that there. So in a way, it's David Bowie asked the wrong question. It's not is there life on Mars? It's was there life on Mars? And what you're hoping to find is tiny fossils of the life on Mars. We're not bringing back little green men in a test tube, are we? It's tiny fossils. But that would be a huge breakthrough, wouldn't it, to discover there had been life on Mars?
Yes. I think there's a very remote possibility that there is still life on Mars, but it would be microbe level, because we now understand that life can survive much more extreme environments than we used to think. So life on Earth, you get it at the cold temperatures in the Arctic. It's very slow living. And also you find deep in the oceans, and we've also found life deep in mines where you wouldn't expect. So we have to treat these samples, no matter how remote it is, that potentially they may have life on them. And I'm saying this is really, really remote, but you have to take that precaution. So the mission's been carefully designed that anything that has seen the surface of Mars will not see the surface of, will not see Earth on its return, and it will, and the samples will go into a biosecure building until we've investigated them and made sure that there's absolutely no life on current life, and we can then go on and look at, is there past life?
And so how excited, there's only a few sort of seconds counting down to this launch now. I think we can listen in to what's happening in the background. How exciting is it for you watching this about to happen?
I have a blend of excitement and nerves, because I have been involved with missions that have not failed on launch.
So let's listen into that live launch, yeah.
Brilliant.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Engine ignition, 2, 1, 0. Release and liftoff. As the countdown to Mars continues, the perseverance of humanity launching the next generation of robotic explorers to the Red Planet.
And Atlas TU has gone to closed loop control.
So this is a radio first for Times Radio. It's only been on air for a month, but bringing you the sound of a rocket launch from NASA taking Perseverance, a rover, to Mars. I'm joined on Times Radio still by Sue Horn, Head of Space Exploration at the UK Space Agency. How do you feel watching that liftoff, Sue?
Really good. I'm still nervous because I know that issues can still happen as the rocket is going up. I calm down once it's got on its flight to Mars. So once it's separated from the rocket and the spacecraft is going to Mars. So that will take a few minutes more, but this is all looking good. It's looking successful to date.
And I, two or three years ago, I happened to be in Florida on a family holiday. And we went down to the Kennedy Space Center and we were lucky enough to see a rocket. I think it was taking some supplies up to the International Space Station. It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? And even some distance away, just the noise, the roar, it's such an incredible sound.
And the vibration, you feel it. You feel it in your body as well.
You really do. You really do. Have you been? You've obviously been there and seen it as a in real life.
I have done one launch, and it was cluster one, and it failed. So I have seen a rocket blow up as well.
Well, that's not something that you necessarily want to have.
But, because we'd been working on the mission for 6 years. We did manage to rebuild it, though, and successfully launch it.
Well, that's at least some good came out of that. Just while we've been on air, Jazz is texted in. Very exciting to hear humans are off to Mars. But not quite humans on board. But remember the moonwalk in the 60s as a schoolgirl and saw the three astronauts as they toured the world. I managed to see a bunch of moon rocks. Well, people do get... I had this argument with Stig Abel on the breakfast show this morning. He was not excited about it. It's exciting, isn't it? Look at the pictures now of just seeing the Earth from the live pictures of a rocket looking back at Earth. It's just exciting, isn't it?
It is exciting. And actually, this is the first step to actually sending astronauts to Mars. That is our long-term goal. But we need to understand Mars, its environment, what hazards are there, is there anything hazardous in the rocks, understand the dust and how that might affect human missions to Mars. So in 20 to 30 years' time, we are looking at potentially astronauts to Mars. We need to go back to the moon, test technology on the moon, and that will help us. That will be our step to Mars.
Even this journey is going to take between now and February next year. They expect Perseverance to launch. So obviously, it's quite a big deal to send astronauts to Mars as well. Just before we move on, would you be tempted to go to Mars? Presumably, it is a one-way trip.
No.
Well, at least you're honest. At least you're honest. So it's nice to see the results. I mean, it'd be exciting to see the rocks when they come back from Mars, but without actually volunteering to go yourself.
I think it needs a certain type of person. I'm not sure I would want to spend 500 days confined in a spacecraft because you've got the return journey. Yeah. I love my family. I like being with my family.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with you. I'll let other people go and they can come back and tell us what they saw. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box podcast. You can now listen back to my whole show on the Times Radio app, where you can also now listen to all of the Times podcasts, including Red Box 2. Make sure you subscribe and review the Red Box podcast wherever you listen. But for now, from me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.